This is the Venturing Angler Podcast. I'm Tim Harden. In this episode, we'll be talking to Al Perkinson from Bahio Sunglasses about an exciting new company over at Bahio and the great work they're doing on environmental issues and the work that Al has done in the past. Let's chat with Al. Here with Al Perkinson. Al, it's been a while. It's good to have you on the Venturing Angler Podcast. Welcome.
Thanks, Tim. It's great to be here, man. Appreciate you having us on.
So just to throw out a very broad question to get us started, because I think there's also often a lot going on with you. What have you been up to lately?
Well, I've been up to starting a new sunglass company called Bahio. And that's been pretty all-consuming for the last probably almost year and a half. And the prior to that, I was at Costa Sunglasses for a long time, 15, 20 years, and built that brand. We were bought by a huge company. I could see that that wasn't the place I wanted to be anymore. So I went out west to Sims and was there for a couple of years and then back to the East Coast and did some consulting and things like that, but really felt like, you know, I had a purpose, I had a mission. And if I wanted to realize that, I couldn't really do it with other brands. I had to have my own brand. So Marguerite and I just sat down and decided we'd go for it and start a new sunglass company. And the timing seemed right. And it's been a blast, man. We've had a great time.
I didn't know really the inner workings of Costa, but it often felt to me like you, in a way, what I was seeing that I liked was largely coming from you. And I think I see this now in Bahio. And I'm going to let you describe that. I mean, this is a very, very different company, and it definitely has the Al Perkinson touch. What's going on with this sunglass company?
Well, you know, It's been really, really cool, that, you know, it's, before, you know, you have a lot of people that you have to sort of wrangle into doing what you want them to do. And so it's really fun when you own the place and you can just do it sort of from like a pure standpoint. You know, we can just do what we want to do. And, when we're starting out, we're like, look, man, if we're going to do this and we're going to put all of our energy into it and all of our passion into it. And, you know, we want to wake up every morning just dying to get to the office and dying to do our thing, then it's got to be driven by our passion, you know. And we're very passionate people, very mission-driven people. And so we asked ourselves, you know, what are the things we're passionate about, you know? And at first we were like trying to be, put our business hat on and think of it in those terms, and it just wasn't working. So we said, look, now personally, what are we passionate about? And it was, what we love to do the most is saltwater flats fishing and exploring and, you know, being out in the bush on pangas and all that kind of stuff. And what we care about is protecting those places, and we see all the threats to them, you know, from all sorts of angles worldwide. It's scary. And then we also love the people that we encounter. You know, we're sort of people who defend the underdog, and in like places like the Caribbean and other places, if you really study the history of it, you know, those folks have been abused by white people, you know, colonialization and everything else for a super long time. And it hasn't honestly even changed that much. So, you know, we've always had sort of a mission, and that's why we started IndieFly, to really empower these local communities and to acknowledge the fact that these are their flats. This is their country. And if they're going to be protected, these folks, no matter, you know, if they don't have a lot of money or not, these folks are going to be the ones who determine whether it gets protected or not. So for their dignity and for their empowerment and for the future of the flats, you know, that the focus on the local communities is a really important part of this. And then finally, I guess, it's about young people, it's about youth. We've always loved to, you know, inspire young people to understand, to get involved in fly fishing, to understand some of the issues that environmentally that face the oceans and other places, and to just get engaged. And, you know, this next generation is totally down with getting engaged and, you know, fixing the planet that we kind of screwed up for them. And so we're just sort of trying to point some of that energy into the oceans, into the flats, and get them involved in fishing. So I would say that, you know, flats conservation and rejuvenation, community engagement with the locals, and then really engaging with the young people and getting them inspired are sort of the three big things that we're all about as a company. One way or other, everything's is gonna ladder up to that.
And how's that been unfolding so far with the company? One thing that stands out to me is the materials.
Yeah, you know, I've always been inspired by Patagonia and Yvonne Chouinard and what they've done. It's interesting, like over the last, I don't know how many years, maybe 10 years or something, they just seem to emphasize more and more the materials that they're using to make their clothing, you know, the ability to recycle their worn wear, all those types of programs that they have, you know, and they've even kind of just gotten away from some of the adventure stuff and some of the other things and just really focused on that. And I think in part that got my attention, but, you know, so we just kind of made it a mandatory thing. You know, I just talked to the team. I was like, guys, every decision we make has got to be low impact on the environment. And, you know, t-shirts is a good example. So we're doing organic t-shirts. We're doing some t-shirts with recycled plastic bottles and all that. But still, all these t-shirts come to you in a plastic bag. And so we said, guys, we don't want these things in plastic bags. Can you ship in a different kind of bag? And they're like, well, we have a biodegradable plastic bag that you can use. We did some research on that. And I was like, yeah, well, it biodegrades in 1,000 years instead of 2,000 years. That's not really a good solution. So we found this company called Eco Enclose out in Colorado, and they make a glassine bag. It's basically a paper bag and totally environmentally friendly, biodegradable. But our t-shirt printer said, look, our machines can't use that bag. So you're going to have to stuff it in the bag yourself. So those shirts come to us now in boxes, and then we have to stuff them all ourselves in-house. And my poor operations guy is like, man, when volume picks up, this is going to kill us. I'm like, sorry, man, this is just what we got to do. So, you know, I think you have to have like a top down almost mandate within the company, because some of these things cost more too, you know, to do. But it's just something that we all value and all believe in, and everybody is embracing to make as small a footprint as we can. And we just all have to, if we're gonna save this freaking planet that we're on, or save ourselves. The planet will be fine after we're gone, but I'd like for us to be able to stick around a while.
Yeah. And then the materials that make up the sunglasses themselves, what was your process with the direction you went to in that regard?
Well, you know, I'd been familiar with some plant-based plastics and had seen those used, and those were working pretty well. A lot of it is getting the factories to agree to use some alternative materials. So we had used a 35% plant-based material before. It was made out of the castor plant and the resins from that plant that get mixed in with nylon. So we wanted to bump that up. So we were able to get 65% plant-based, but it still has 35% nylon in it, right? So it's not 100% where we want it to be. So we started really experimenting with a lot of other materials. There's We'll have a recycled plastic bottle frame coming out in the next couple of weeks. And we'll have, we're experimenting with coconut husk. Hadn't been able to crack that quite yet. It's still a little bit too brittle. You know, the stuff has to perform well. And then we've got another material that we're coming out with next year that is 100% what we want it to be. And so we're excited about that. But it's, you know, it's just an experiment constantly. You like chase something down, you hear about something, you chase it down, and then you dig into it. Luckily, our product development guys, this is their specialty. You know, they are some of the best at materials and eco-friendly materials in the world. And we're lucky to have them. And they just track it down. They lift up the hood. They find out exactly what this stuff is made of, what all the processes are. And half the time, we're disappointed that it didn't pan out. So you got to start all over and go down another route. And sometimes you end up with something that's not perfect, but it's better than it was before, you know? So we, you know, we've done that with our sunglass cases. We went down the path of, you know, finding something that was environmentally friendly. And oddly enough, we ended up with 100% leather case that uses water-soluble tanning materials, chemicals to tan it. So it doesn't harm the environment at all. It's basically food byproduct, you know, that would be wasted. And then it biodegrades. So it doesn't wear out. You know, well, you'll keep it your whole life. But when it does, it's biodegradable. So it's, if you add it all up, you're like, you know, we're not big fans of beef production and what's happening in Argentina and the rainforests and all that. That's a big negative. But on balance, you know, that case is a really eco-friendly case, passes Prop 65, you know. But we're switching from that case primarily because of the beef issue to a cactus leather case that'll be coming out in the next couple of weeks. And that's made from cactus plants, which don't take any water to grow, really. And then when they harvest, they dry it out in the sun, so it doesn't take any electricity to do that. And so the materials manufacturer is, it's REACH certified, which is a European standard, which is much more stringent than Prop 65. And it's made in Mexico instead of Asia, so we don't have the carbon footprint of bringing it over here. And so on balance there, now we think the cactus is going to be better. So there's a lot of thought that goes into it, a lot of decisions, but the overall value and principle is, let's have as low of an impact as we possibly can on the planet when we're making all these products. So that's kind of where we're at on it.
That's great. And it could be an industry game changer, who knows, but it's great to see you taking the lead for sure. I've noticed throughout the years that you know, similar to Yvon Chouinard, have tried to find ways that businesses could support values that especially businesses in the outdoor industry ought to uphold. When did this start with you?
Well, it probably started a pretty long time ago. I mean, I grew up in a household where my dad was a not-for-profit guy. He was a college president, and so was around, you know, education and really interesting people and who had values other than just money. You know, if you're a professor of poetry, yeah, you got to make a living, but you're kind of more passionate about poetry. That's what you want to focus on. And so I grew up in a household that had those values. And then oddly enough, when I went to work and I went to graduate school, actually in New York, and studied arts management. So it was sort of not-for-profit business management. And it was half creativity. You know, I would take sculpture class in the morning, and then I'd take accounting class in the afternoon and in the grad school. And it was kind of mind-blowing trying to make both sides of your brain work that way. But anyway, long story short, I went to work at Ogilvy in New York. And my client was, the account that I worked on was American Express. Well, American Express and Ogilvy, right at that time, created something called cause-based marketing. And so they would, American Express would say to its, say to the customers in advertising, hey, if you get a card this month, we'll donate $5 to this local charity. In New York, it was the South Street Seaport, for example. And then, you know, for the next 2 months, 1% of all charge volume will go to support that charity as well. And it just blew up. I mean, people were like, wow, I can use my spending power to actually affect some good. And that's, I think that's when it sort of sparked with me that, you know, business, I wasn't sure if business was going to be my thing or not. You know, it just wasn't inspiring. But when you put the cause into the business, all of a sudden it became inspiring. And, you know, and the more you, and there's been a lot of other companies that have sort of jumped on that train. Patagonia was right there at the start as well. So I read everything I could about Patagonia and was super inspired by them. And they're all 1% for the planet and, you know, letting not-for-profits have office space in their offices. I just thought all that was really, really cool and kind of became a student of it. So I think it's been part of what I've wanted to do my whole career. And then, you know, when I first came to Costa, I was sort of given the reins and allowed to do what I wanted to do as long as it was successful. And so the whole team bought into it, and that became a big part of the whole brand and the whole message. And we were able to really take that a long way and perfect a lot of those sort of techniques and ideas over the time there. You've got to have the ownership that allows you, not just allows you to do it, but actually is getting behind it and pushing it. And you know, I really came to believe over time that ownership structure was really probably the biggest factor in allowing companies to be cause driven. You know, because it's the difference between sort of greenwashing and between really, really making a difference. And, you know, business companies, that is where the money is. If you look at any economy in the world and you say, you know, where is the money? The money is in the economy, it's in businesses. So if we can, and that's where the power is. So if we can channel that, those resources, channel that money into causes, social problems, environmental problems, we can solve the problems that we have in the world in like 5 minutes. We really can. If every big corporation would sort of take up a cause and say, I'm not just going to write a check, but we are going to really get behind this cause, we would make a change. We would make a huge change. We would solve these problems, right? But the thing that gets in the way, and apologize for soapbox, but the thing that gets in the way is greed, is corporate greed in my mind. And if you look at what is behind almost every environmental problem that we have, it is greed and corporate greed. And corporations are run by people. So really it's the greed of the people, you know. So I really believe that if businesses can get off that model and find a way to embrace social change, that's the secret. That's the answer. So that's in our little company, in our little niche, that's what we're going to do. And, you know, hope maybe it will inspire somebody else to do the same thing. But that doesn't matter. We're still going to make as much of a difference, you know, as we possibly can.
One of the things you mentioned earlier, was IndieFly. And I always want to take advantage of the opportunity to introduce people who might not be familiar with what IndieFly is up to, but also you were right there at the beginning. I'd love for you to say more about IndieFly and your role there.
Sure. IndieFly, before IndieFly was IndieFly, it was a project that we started down in Guyana in a little village called Rewa. And we, you know, a buddy of mine took me down there years ago, and you know, he said, man, you just gotta check out this little village here because I think they're doing the kind of stuff that you would get excited about. So we went there, and we found out that this little tiny village of 200 people is way out in the middle of the rainforest. I mean, you have to fly on a plane from Georgetown 2.5 hours over nothing but broccoli to land on a dirt runway and then get in the boat and go 3 hours to get to this place. It's remote. And these folks had, they'd kind of been infiltrated by, some business people who wanted to extract skins and tropical fish and parakeets and all of that for pet shops in the UK and in the United States. And so they had gotten on this train of a sort of poaching and harvesting, over harvesting their local wildlife just to sell for pennies to these folks who were, wanting to make a lot of money in the States. And so this little village of Rewa said, you know what, we see that all of our wildlife is disappearing and we don't like it. We think that they're super important to our grandchildren and their children. And we're going to stop. We're going to stop poaching. We're going to stop killing the wildlife. We don't know where we're going to get money to do the little things that we need to do, but doesn't matter. We're just going to stop. And when they did, all the wildlife came back in their little area. There's 22 other villages that did not stop. And so they, their wildlife continued to be depleted. And so we figured out that, hey, these guys, to make this work long-term, they're going to need some kind of income. And when you're there, you immediately, I immediately saw, geez, this would be an incredible fly fishing destination. They got the arapaima, which is this massive fish, plus they got 400 other species of fish. And it's just an explorer's paradise. Plus, you're in this remote village. Cell phones don't work. Computers don't work. You're actually seeing people who were living the way they did 200 years ago, almost. And so, it just instantly we're like, hey, this would be a great fly fishing destination. So we pulled all the leaders of the village together that same week we were there. And explain how fly fishing works and, how a lodge might work. And they're like, okay, let's do it. You're going to help us, right? And so I couldn't say no at that point. And, it was a hard sell back at the office. Like, where is Guyana and what are you doing? And what the hell does this have to do with sunglasses? But somehow we were able to step by step build this successful business down there with them. And we ended up making a cool little film about it, and it got in the Sundance Festival, and so it got all this attention. And then people in Washington wanted to look at our model and see how we had done it, and maybe spread that around the world. And so at that point, Matt Schilling and Oliver were involved in the project and said, hey guys, would y'all like to join together and create this foundation, IndieFly, and take this model all over the world? And they're like, sure, man. So Matt was coming out of Washington, been there for years and worked at the White House. And he said, I'll run it. I'll be the executive director. And I'm like, cool. And Oliver's like, hey man, I know how to run lodges. I'll do that. And I'm like, well, I know how to do marketing. I'll do that. And then we brought in Andy Danilchuk, who was one of the premier fisheries biologists in the world, who's up at Amherst at UMass. And he's like, hey, I'll be your science guy. And then, Pat Murray, who's president of CCA, he said, hey man, I can help y'all, teach y'all how to run a foundation. I know how to do that. And then we brought in David Yaskowitz, who is now executive director at the Heart Institute down in Houston. And then we brought on a couple of other folks to be on our board since then. But that was kind of the core group that we started out with, and then started looking at projects, and it, all of us having full-time jobs and trying to do this thing part-time, but we've been able to make progress. And I think the most exciting thing is what's happening on the Wind River Reservation right now. So we're taking the model from Rewa, from another country, and bringing it back home to our indigenous people. And it has huge potential to be spread to tribes all over the country. So that's taking most of our energy right now on IndieFly. I'm still on the board. I turned over the chairmanship to Oliver in the last 6 months so I could do this sunglass thing. But I'm hoping to make it full circle and be able to make a financial contribution through Bahio to IndyFly. I guess we've already done that. But it'll grow over time. So it's a cool concept. And I just think it's very much in line with what our values are at Bahio, and, you know, in terms of empowering the indigenous people, and, the same issues as before, that we talked about before, in terms of these folks needing some empowerment, needing some help. And it's amazing that these situations exist all over the world. And indigenous people control, I don't know, I never can remember the percentage, but it's like over half of all the remaining wilderness is controlled by them. So, embracing them, supporting them, helping them survive and flourish is super important to the planet.
Yeah. And it's great work that you all did there, and that's ongoing. And at the beginning of the podcast, you talked about the importance of communities, and IndyFly's work really turns things over to the communities there, and it's pretty incredible.
Yeah, one of the tenets is that the locals own it, right? They own the lodge, they own the business, and we work to gradually turn it over to them. They don't know how to, for the most part, don't know how to run it at the beginning, but we're not being like paternalistic to them. We're like, look, guys, you're going to learn to do this, and we're going to help you, but we're going to sort of decrease our involvement over time so that you can become independent and self-reliant. And that's where the real value is. And that's what's going to give you some super, long-term satisfaction for sure.
You also mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, an interest in exploration, and you're even a member of the Explorers Club in New York City. How is Bahio, embracing that passion for exploration that you and others share?
Well, we're always looking for projects, and it's fun to kind of get back in the groove, of saying, hey, man, we got to go check this place out. Has amazing potential, either there's a problem there that these guys need help with, or it's a place that has not been explored very heavily before. I've got my buddy Jay Johnson sitting right here, editing our new TV show that we got working. He is probably the most uber explorer on the planet.
Yeah.
And has done a lot more than I have. But, you have exploration sort of in your soul, or you don't, and a lot of us in the fly fishing world seem to. So anyway, one of the things that there are a couple of reasons that we're kind of emphasizing exploration, and we're doing it through this project called the Odyssey. Probably the first great exploration of Homer back in the day, Ulysses and Odyssey. But so we borrowed that name. But anyway, that the Odyssey is just kind of a long-term sort of idea. But one of the missions of bringing in more young people, into fly fishing is, those folks really love to explore. And so when we start talking about exploration, they get super jazzed about it, because they're exploring to kind of figure out who they are and what they want to do, what they're all about. And so they're, the explorer archetype is super active with those guys. And so as, we created this thing called the Odyssey, and the purpose of the Odyssey is to kind of checks all the boxes that we're focused on. So one, we're going to saltwater flats around the world. So we have a 5-year plan that's laid out. We'll do 4 to 5 places per year. And then within each place, we'll look to engage with the local community, and we'll look to learn about the issues that each of these flats and these places face. What are the threats? And then we'll look at what can we do to help mitigate some of those threats. And then we're capturing it all on film and on photography, which we then publish, and it inspires younger people and others, hopefully, to get involved and to be a part of helping out with some of these solutions. And then we're also reaching out to the local universities and trying to get those kids engaged and involved in the flats. And what we hope will happen over time is kind of a big, you know, bit of a pie in the sky type of concept, but that's kind of what we do. And if you don't reach for something big, you're definitely not going to hit it. Sometimes you might not hit it, but maybe you get close, you know? So I think what I would love to see happen over time, and it's already happening, so I know it's going to happen, is that the local kids get connected with our kids and they get focused on, you know, solving some of those problems that are affecting the flats. They get turned on to fly fishing, and then that network starts growing as we go from place to place, then more join and more join and more join. And with social media, with the internet, they can stay super connected. So we create a big global community that can lobby their governments and fight against corporations who are coming in and just taking and not giving, and stop all the craziness that's going on out there, and protect these incredibly important places ecologically and incredibly important places just from a psyche of the world. You know, if you look at the flats, if you ask somebody, what is your definition of paradise? Well, it's probably beautiful blue water and palm trees. They're describing the flats, right? And corporations, corporate greed, pollution, you know, you've got ocean trash, you've got dredging, you've got extractive industries from sand mining to gold mining to whatever. You've got deforestation, you've got mangrove destruction from overdevelopment. You've got coral reef bleaching because water temperatures are rising. And we could go on and list 10 other things, right? But all of it, to me, it traces back to people taking without any concern for the damage that they're doing, right? And so that is a big force that has to be fought. And I think that we can bring the young people together, and together we can fight those forces, and we can save paradise. I really believe we can do that.
That's terrific. And you mentioned Oliver earlier. I think you were involved in the film that showed all the plastic pollution, the film short in the Bahamas. You know, I've been down to Ascension Bay, and I feel like I'm 2 or 3 hours from Cancun and still can't escape plastic pollution. And it really points right back to us time and time again.
Oh, man, we started a program a while back called Kick Plastic, and it just resonated with it. At that time, people were like, what is ocean trash? Don't know anything about it. But that might have been 10 years ago. And in the last 10 years, everywhere we go now, it is just everywhere. I mean, it is incredible how much trash is washing up on the beaches. And certain places get dumped on more than others just because of the currents, you know, that carry them. But it's, you know, the cruise ships are doing it. It's, you know, just garbage dumping off the coast. They take garbage barges out and just dump the trash. Single-use plastic bottles. You know, I mean, I live at the beach, and we go to the grocery store, and I just see the tourists coming in loading up on case after case of freaking plastic bottles. And it's all I can do to get, you know, keep Marguerite from going and getting in their face, you know, but that's what you feel like you want to do, because there's just like so many people just have no idea the cause and effect and what these convenience decisions are doing, you know, to our environment. I mean, it's ridiculous.
I'll never forget before a trade show in Florida. I, you know, you talk to people all day. I didn't want to have bad breath. So I went into Wawa, bought Altoids, and the person put the can of Altoids, the tin, into a plastic bag and handed it to me. I just couldn't believe it. And, you know, when you think about just our behavior, including mine, and I'm someone who wants to do my best, you go into a grocery store and aside for, you know, take out the produce section, you're buying item after item that's plastic, wrapped in plastic, and then you check out and they put it in a plastic bag, and it's excessive. It's excessive. And the work that you've done has really cut back on that. I think, I can't remember the exact number, but prior to the hurricane at Abaco Lodge, having, you know, replacing the plastic bottles, I think saved 140,000 bottles a year or something like that, at just one small lodge.
Yeah, I mean, the guides have really stepped up and, you know, taking it seriously and switched over to, you know, metal bottles or big containers and, you know, pouring water into cups and stuff like that. And it's amazing when you start adding it all up, like how many millions and millions of those things we produce and dispose of. And now that the Chinese have stopped buying a lot of, I mean, it's kind of crazy that we recycle all of this waste and then we ship it over to China because they repurpose it in their manufacturing. So we're actually shipping this stuff across the ocean to China, man. It's crazy. And then China stopped buying it recently. And so now so many of the recycling folks are just dumping it in landfills because they don't have a market to sell it. So there's still a lot we do, you know, recycling is great. We're doing a lot better at it, but there's just some fundamental problems. And a lot of it comes in packaging. I mean, there's, you know, there's groups now who are really, and there's like award shows and stuff that reward people, companies for having better packaging that's more environmentally friendly. And, you know, I mean, we all get stuff in the mail and you start unpacking it and it's just like plastic after plastic after plastic. You're like, oh my gosh, you know? So, I mean, that's another thing we focused on is our packaging to make recycled, our boxes are made out of recycled paper, and recycled paper is a really, really good material to use whenever you can. You know, the shipping boxes are also made recycled cardboard, and it's, you know, it's not that much more expensive, and sometimes it's even cheaper, but it, you know, every little bit helps. So, but yeah, it all comes back to us, man. And just, we've got to make those changes.
Yeah. And I'm glad you mentioned the transport. I mean, one thing that often gets overlooked because we pay attention to the pollution, which is of course important, but the production involves, you know, truck after truck after truck of that's involved in the extraction process and then the transportation of that to refineries and so forth until it's eventually turned into the product that we use once, toss, and then it gets transported somewhere else for hopefully for recycling. And, you know, I've got a relative who's done pretty well with fracking and offshore drilling. And I said to him once, like, man, I wish you'd stop doing this. And he said, you're buying it. And it was,
yeah,
you know, it's, there's culpability to go around, and it's exciting to see that you're taking steps that, do make change and also make it easier for all of us that are addicted to this, you know, consumption and, waste and one use waste and then waste that we don't even think about, just like you said with packaging. It's too often that I order like vitamins from Amazon and it's wrapped in bubble wrap within plastic and, you know, boxed and shipped in a, you know, 18 inch long cardboard box. And so these changes are fundamental to our a healthy future for all of us.
Yeah. And I don't know. I think a lot of these are recent inventions, relatively speaking. And we just haven't matured enough to really understand how to manage these inventions, and these inventions like plastic have just pretty much taken over the world. And it's, you know, I think we'll be able to figure it out and get smarter and manage the stuff better. And I do think that the threat of, from carbon emissions and global warming is ultimately going to be the big one that's going to really fundamentally shift everything. And you can see it starting to happen. I mean, to have so many car companies now offering electric vehicles or hybrid vehicles, and it's just happened really quickly. It's starting to be encouraging, you know, that maybe we've gotten over the hump. Maybe we are going to focus on this enough to, you know, stem, you know, not to be doom and gloom, but it's real, you know, and so to stem those challenges and push off catastrophe, or, you know, maybe save us all together would be awesome. So I'm hopeful that we're starting to see a significant enough change to where we're turning the corner on it.
Well, there is a real doom and gloom aspect to it that's real. But at the same time, you know, one thing that's been interesting to me as I've evolved in recent years in my thinking, because things have changed overall, I always thought, and I still think this to some degree, that, you know, big business is a big part of the problem. And, you know, it's going to take the federal government to, you know, control our appetites when it comes to practices that are detrimental to the planet. But, you know, it's easy to make the case that the government has come up short in recent years. And what's been impressive to me is a number of states and then businesses have stepped up. And so now I take a lot of hope in watching businesses like yours and Patagonia and, you know, many others, like, you know, don't want to say it, but, you know, Ford and General Motors are going to bring about change that's important. And if it weren't for their initiatives, you know, regardless of what motivates it, you know, we'd be in worse shape. And so I'm putting a lot of hope in what companies are doing.
Yeah, I am too. I mean, and if you think about it, how it was maybe, you know, 15 or 20 years ago versus how it is now, that whole conversation, the whole dialogue has moved from kind of obscure up to the forefront, almost to the forefront. So that's, I think that's super encouraging. And look, you know, you can't really sell doom and gloom. You know, you have to sell hope. And this stuff, you know, there is hope. And the hope is in the next generation who, you know, they believe in this stuff down to their core, right? This is not just greenwashing or not just corporate responsibility. This is something they've grown up with and that they really believe in. And if we give them an opportunity to just act on that and get involved in a real way, then I think their end will take over and we'll get there.
Well, it's exciting to see what you all are up to. Where can folks go to learn more?
Well, we've got, you know, our social media is cranking. So we've got an Instagram page that's pretty active and we're trying to put a lot of our stuff up there. Facebook, we're, you know, got an active page there. And then we have a website, BahioSunglasses.com, which is about to get a facelift already, but it's has some information. It's getting ready to have a lot more about all the projects that we're doing and how folks, ways for folks to get engaged.
Terrific. Well, Al, thanks for coming on. And I enjoyed the conversation and I look forward to seeing more exciting things to come from Bahio.
Hey, thanks, Tim. Appreciate it, man. Thanks for having me.